We've been talking about what it means to do justice. We want to continue that conversation this morning, but we want to look at this through the lens of what the Old Testament refers to as shalom. In order to just stir our thinking a little bit, I want to start by thinking about an industry that pretty much all of us have to have contact with, that tends to have a reputation that perhaps isn't always real positive. And that would be the auto industry. The auto industry is a tough industry. And I think over time, there's those who have gained a reputation for kind of being those who advantage themselves by disadvantaging others. I would say at the end of the day, there's always been those in the industry that have treated people unfairly. There's also, I think, always been those in the industry who have sought to operate with the highest degree of integrity. So like all industries, there's the good and the bad. If you think about the auto industry, you tend to think about money and profit and working a deal, and you wonder if the repairs are always what's necessary, and we kind of get into that frame of mind. But what if we completely changed our thinking and thought about it like this? Can you imagine very many industries in our community that are as basic and fundamental to what you need to make it in our community? In other words, it's as basic as if you're going to have a job, if you're going to go to school, if you're going to have a family and take your kids to school and to the doctor and to soccer and go to church and serve in a ministry. When you start to think about it all, Lincoln isn't exactly a community with a lot of mass transit. If you don't have a car, it would be very difficult to really make it. So if we start thinking about the auto industry in those terms, what if a salesman, instead of thinking that this is really an opportunity to wheel and deal and make the best deal possible in order to make more money, what if that salesman was in the frame of mind that if I was to give someone the opportunity to have safe, reliable transportation at a reasonable cost, I am actually giving this person a chance. This person a chance to grow. This person a chance to advance. This person a chance to pursue his or her hopes and dreams. By just doing this fairly, I'm actually giving somebody a chance to make it. And what if the mechanic began to think, instead of just turning a wrench to somehow make a profit, that what I'm doing is by doing my job well and giving somebody safe, reliable transportation, what I'm actually doing is giving someone a chance. I'm contributing to the possibility that they could pursue their dreams and have a chance to advance and to grow and to experience life and joy in our community. It would be a completely different way of looking at an industry that we all interact with. Now, I don't think this is new. I think there are those in the auto industry, they get this. And they're seeking to do exactly that. To be in that frame of mind would be what the Old Testament refers to as shalom. That's what we want to talk about. If you have a Bible, turn with me this morning to Proverbs chapter 3. The entire Old Testament talks about the concept of shalom. We're going to limit our conversation this morning just to the book of Proverbs. If you're unfamiliar with Proverbs, it's a collection of short, pithy statements or a collection of proverbs. It's a little hard to outline and to organize, but it's full of lots of wisdom. Proverbs 3, verse 1, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. Verse 2 is the introduction of the concept of shalom in the Proverbs. Shalom is a Hebrew word that's typically translated peace. It's one of those Hebrew words that a lot of people throw around, but very few people actually know what it means. When the text says peace, it's not just talking about the absence of war. It's not just talking about kind of being quiet and peaceful. It's actually a very big, comprehensive concept. It's about wholeness. It's about health. It's about a universal flourishing of a community. Alvin Plantinga, in his wonderful book entitled Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, has an entire chapter on what he calls the vandalism of shalom. He reminds us that God's vision in original creation was for shalom, but sin has done vandalism to shalom. Sin destroys shalom. One of the metaphors he uses, which is a biblical metaphor for shalom, is the idea of a piece of fabric. It's the idea of thousands of threads that are woven together with other threads that creates hundreds of thousands of intersecting points that ultimately come together to make a fabric. It's the fabric of shalom that holds us up. It's the idea of an individual, a family, a neighborhood, the government, the marketplace, schools, social agencies, all intersecting one another, all working together in order to create an environment where everybody can flourish. If you think of an orchestra playing a magnificent piece of music, we would refer to that as musical shalom, harmony, all the different instruments, all the different notes coming together to make something beautiful. That's the concept of shalom. For shalom to work, people must be willing to disadvantage themselves in order to advantage the greater community. Everybody working together that we all might flourish. Sin, then, is the enemy of shalom. It does violence to shalom. It does vandalism to shalom. It unravels the fabric because sin at its very essence is selfish. And when I'm willing to disadvantage others in order to advantage myself, I start to unravel the fabric of shalom. Literally, what you're doing when you do that is you're sawing off the very branch you're sitting on. Because when the fabric of shalom comes unraveled, everybody pays the price. Plantinga summarizes his chapter by saying, because God is for shalom, God is against sin. God's vision for the world he created was for shalom. God's vision for redemption is the restoration of shalom. That's what it means to do justice. We pick it up then in verse 13. How blessed is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. The Proverbs talk a lot about wisdom. I think the best way to think about wisdom is skillful living. Oftentimes, then, wisdom is personified, in this case, in the female voice, as if wisdom is a person. For her profit is better than the profit of silver, and her gain better than fine gold. She is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire compares with her. Long life is in her right hand. In her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are pleasant ways, and all her paths are shalom. In verse 1, we were told that by listening to God's teachings and keeping his commandments is how we weave together shalom. Now, farther in the chapter, how we live skillfully is by following God's commandments, which are more valuable than gold and silver, but do produce riches. The riches then are used in order to create shalom. That's what the text is saying. Then he goes on and uses creation as a model of shalom. Verse 19, the Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. By his knowledge, the deeps were broken up, and the skies drip with dew. God's vision for shalom can be seen in the world in which he's created, even though sin has affected perfect creation. Romans 8 says all creation groans and awaits redemption. There is still a sense of shalom within the world that God has made. The universe is remarkable in terms of its ability to function together in a finely tuned universe that gives us the world in which we live in. Over the years, as we've advanced in technology, all we really learn is that regardless of how much we know, we still don't know very much. I'm always intrigued by the scientist who discovers another great wonder, and in discovering that, seems to think of himself or herself in some form as God. And I would say, now wait a minute here. God wouldn't be the one who discovers the wonder. God would be the one who created the wonder. And when you look at the universe, it is magnificent in terms of its ability to work together. To think somehow this finely tuned universe is merely a product of chance is quite a remarkable leap of faith. What the writer of Proverbs is saying is the universe is a marvel of shalom, which is a reminder of what we're about in social shalom. Move on then to verse 27. Do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come back, and tomorrow I will give it, when you have it with you. The proverb is saying that we are responsible to do what we can do. It's more the idea of breaking life into days and moments. I may not at this moment be able to help starving children somewhere else in the world. But if in this moment there is something I can do that has to do with restoring shalom, has to do with doing justice, would just simply be the right thing, then I should do that. I'm responsible for that. I'm accountable for that. The word good, do not withhold good, is an interesting Hebrew word. When we think of goodness, we tend to think of morality and right and wrong, and that's correct. But this Hebrew word for good goes beyond that to the idea of action. It flows out of the Hebrew model of education. We in the West embrace a Greek model of education, which is basically if you can regurgitate information on a test, then you know it. But the Hebrew model was very different from that. The Hebrew model was, if you don't live it, you don't know it. They literally did not have a category for head knowledge. It was as simple as, if you're not doing it, you don't know it. So what this word implies is if you don't act, you're not good. Good means you do something. James has almost the exact same argument in the New Testament. James chapter 2 says, okay, if you're a person of faith and someone knocks on your door and they're in need of food or they're in need of warmth, and you say to them, go be warm and be filled, and you turn them away, he asks the question, what good has that done? What good has that done if you haven't actually done what was necessary to meet that need? It's the exact same idea here, that if we have within our potential, our capacity, the ability to do something, to do justice, then it's our responsibility to do it. Now, that's pretty straightforward. I doubt anybody's going to argue with that. Where the proverb gets quite interesting is the last part of verse 27. When it says, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due. Now, what does that mean? Literally, what the Hebrew means is those for whom it's deserved, those who have the right. In other words, is the proverb saying that those people have the right to expect some of my stuff? The answer is yes, that is what it's saying. Now, it's built on several levels of theology. First of all, it's not promoting the idea of an attitude of entitlement. It's not talking about those that are lazy, those that won't work, those that won't take care of themselves, those that are advantaging the system. Those would be included among the wicked. Those are people that are advantaging themselves by disadvantaging everybody else. It's not talking about that. And the Proverbs would be very clear about that. But what it is talking about is the reminder that at the end of the day, it's really not your stuff. If your response is, why should they have access to my stuff? I think the first thing God would say is because it's not your stuff. The Bible's very clear from beginning to end, it's God's stuff. And you're merely a steward of it. And God says they have a right to my stuff. So that's the starting point. It's also understanding that when shalom unravels, when sin does vandalism to shalom, it never shakes out fairly. There are those who receive far more than others. And the vision of shalom is we all take what we have and use it to try to bring about shalom within and a group, within a community. So think of it like this. There's a tendency for us to think that I have what I have because I've worked really hard. I have what I have because I've gone to college and I've been disciplined and I really work and I've accumulated, and that's why I have what I have. We talked about this in the Amos series, and I would say, good for you. That accounts for about 2% of how you got where you are. You say, well, what do you mean? I mean about 98% of everything is totally out of your control. To think somehow you've done this is absolutely ludicrous. You've had no control of whether you were born in the 20th century or the 10th century. You had no control of whether you were born in the United States or you're born in the streets of India. You had no control of whether you were born to a loving family or an abusive family. You had no control over whether your mom was a drug addict or a wonderful, loving mother. You've had no control over your talents and gifts and abilities that are gifts from God. You've had no control over whether you were born crippled or healthy. You've had no control over whether you were in a car accident and crippled for life or you're still healthy. You have no control of whether or not you were hit by a drunk driver. You have no control over whether you have cancer. You have no control over whether you're blind or can see. You have no control over these things. And actually, the very fact that you have breath in your lungs today is a gift of God. When you see it that way, what you actually control is maybe 1% or 2%. So good for you for maximizing that. But don't start thinking you've done it all. When shalom shakes out, it just doesn't land fairly. So think of it like this. Last week, Mark talked to you about a couple of initiatives that we're putting forth where people can get involved in a very simple way to make a significant difference in our city. One of those was getting involved through City Impact to be a volunteer to help students learn to read. It can virtually change the life of one of these students. Or to connect as a mentor to one of these children through City Impact. He also talked about the possibility of investigating foster care, that we as churches in the state of Nebraska could come together and actually resolve this so every child would have a loving Christian home to belong to. Now, in each of those cases, we could argue for the rest of the day. What are the causes? Who shall we blame that these children are in these situations? Is it the breakdown of the family? Is it a moral breakdown? Is it a community breakdown? Is it a breakdown in the social structures? We could argue that till the sun goes down. But I'm going to guess there's not a single person in this room this morning that would say it's the child's fault. It's not the child's fault. The child didn't ask for that. And so when shalom comes down, it doesn't come down fairly. And some of these children suffer the consequences of that. Others of us have been quite blessed. The idea of the proverb is saying, then it's the responsibility of the blessed to catch a vision for what God intended in shalom, and it is the right of those who have difficult circumstances to expect that the people of God would come alongside, share their resources, and at least give them a fighting chance. We talked about this in the Amos series. This isn't just about compassion. This isn't just about generosity. This is about right and wrong. They have the right to expect that from us because it's God's stuff and it needs to be redistributed after the fabric of shalom has been torn apart. That's what the psalm is talking about. Right in that same line of thinking, turn to chapter 11. In verse 10, it says, when it goes well with the righteous, the city rejoices. And when the wicked perish, there is joyful shouting. Now, the Hebrew phrase goes well basically means when somebody prospers, when somebody has abundance, when somebody is wildly successful, when somebody becomes wealthy. You remember we learned at the end of the book of Amos that God has no problem with prosperity. He has no problem with abundance. He has no problem with blessing his people. The issue is, what do we do with the abundance that God has given us? That's the core of the issue. Whether we're going to be selfish and greedy or whether we're going to catch a vision to restore shalom. So why does it say, when it goes well, when somebody in the marketplace prospers wildly, why would the city rejoice? That Hebrew word translated, the city rejoices, is almost exclusively used for a city that is celebrating a military victory. The idea is this. When the army goes out to battle, the entire city is at risk. If the army loses, it isn't just the army that loses. The city loses. The enemy's going to come. They're going to pillage. They're going to rape. Life as those people know it has come to an end. Everybody loses. On the other hand, when the army wins, everybody wins. That's the background of this term. So again, why is the text saying that when somebody wildly prospers in the marketplace, the whole city rejoices? The key to understanding that is to notice the one who is succeeding is the tzaddik, is the righteous, is the one who is willing to disadvantage himself in order to advantage others, the one who has captured a vision for shalom, the one who understands it's my job to take what God has given me and redistribute it in order to weave back the fabric of shalom in our community that we all might prosper together. Some of you are wired up for the marketplace. You get out there and man, you get in the zone and you just feel like this is what I'm made for. This is what I'm wired up for. But sometimes it's confusing. I still don't understand how this fits in God's economy. I mean, we understand the value system of the world. If it's just about making money, if it's just about prosperity, if it's just about abundance, if it's more house, more stuff, more cars, more, so I can impress everybody around me so they'll think I'm somebody. That's the value system of the world. But if we don't embrace that, if we say that's not what we're about, sometimes it's confusing. Why has God wired me to experience success in the marketplace? The answer, I think, is in the proverb that when you succeed, when you're prosperous, when you get in the zone and God blesses that, you have a chance to capture God's vision for shalom and to turn around and to share that with others in order that the city might rejoice and say, it's awesome that you succeeded because we all benefited from that. Now, I need to be really clear what we mean by that, because over the years, I've had many business people say to me something like this. You know, Pastor Clark, we're working this deal, and it's a really big deal, and it has the potential of bringing in $5 million, so I want you to pray with me about it, because if God brings in $5 million, I promise I will tithe 10% to God's kingdom. I'll guarantee you that's a prayer God will not answer. That's a great deal for you. Kind of a lousy deal for God, and a lousy deal for Shalom. How about this? How about you keep 20% and God gets 80% to restore shalom? Every person in this room could easily live on $500,000 a year. To understand what we're saying is not just giving back a little percentage of it. It's capturing a vision for shalom. Over the years, I've had countless business people say to me, I really want to grow a kingdom-minded business, and out of the profits, I want to support God's kingdom, which is a wonderful thing. But very few over the years have ever done that. Something happens along the way. We just spend more. We just consume more. We just buy more stuff. We don't get to the point where we really realize God's vision for this, for shalom, and something changes. And God blesses us wildly, and we pour those resources back into capturing God's vision for shalom. The proverb also says that when the wicked are destroyed, the city rejoices. The city says, you know, that person was advantaging himself or herself by disadvantaging the community. So when they go out of business, everybody cheers. Because when they do business that way, everybody loses. So think of it this way. What if we collectively, as a body of believers, prayed for those people in the marketplace that are wired up in such a way that God could bless them with significant prosperity? As long as that person is a tzaddik, and as long as that person gets God's vision for shalom, it would be a righteous prayer to say, God, we're praying that you would cause those businesses to prosper beyond their wildest imagination so the city could rejoice and we could bring shalom to our city. I would say that's a very right prayer. I would equally say it's a right prayer that, God, we pray that you would shut down every business that is destroying shalom, every business that advantages itself by disadvantaging the community, shut them down and we will cheer. That would be a correct application of that proverb. We pray for the righteous and we pray for the shutdown or the demise of the wicked. Very interesting in Jeremiah chapter 29, if you want to read just a little bit more about this, when the Assyrians came and captured the Hebrew people in 722 BC, hauled them into captivity, then the Babylonians conquered the Assyrians. Jeremiah writes, while the Hebrew people were under the Babylonians, and in chapter 29, he says to the Hebrews, make this city flourish. I guarantee you that was a pagan city to the core. But what God was saying is marry, have children, do business, do everything in your power to cause this city to flourish in the name of God. That the people of this city would realize that their city is better because the people of God live there. Tim Keller, the pastor of a Presbyterian church in New York City, who's done a significant amount of good in the inner cities of New York, said that early on in his ministry, he went to a conference and there was a speaker, a missionary from the inner city, said something he's never forgotten. That if you really understand God's vision for Shalom, you understand that you're not there to see how you can use the resources of the city to create a great church, but you're there to use the resources of the church in order to create a great city. It's exactly what Jeremiah 29 says. The last proverb I want to look at is in chapter 29. Chapter 29, verse 7 says, the righteous, the tzaddik, is concerned for the rights of the poor. The wicked does not understand such concern. What's interesting about this proverb is the word translated concerned. It is the Hebrew word yada, which is the word that typically is used to describe the sexual relations between a husband and wife, to describe the intimate relationship that God wants to have with his people. It's a word filled with passion. Literally, what the text is saying is the tzaddik is as passionate about shalom as a husband is passionate about his wife. On the other hand, the wicked don't even get it. So the wicked don't even understand. They don't care. It's hard to imagine, but perhaps there are some of you that have been here through the Amos series, and in your mind you're thinking, that's enough of this stuff. I don't get it. I don't care about it. Nobody oppresses the poor. Let's get over it and move on. I don't know how you could possibly have God within you and think that way. How can you be so far off from the very heartbeat of God? What the text is saying is the wicked, they don't get it, they don't understand, they don't care about it, they don't even want to talk about it. But the tzaddik, who is in tune with the heart of God, is as passionate about this as a husband is passionate about his wife. Okay, this is week number 9. Enough talk. It's time to do. So that's the question. What are we going to do to let justice flow? Last week, Mark talked to you about some possibilities. I mentioned those earlier. Again, the possibility of being a part of City Impact's reading program in the inner city, of being part of mentoring one of these children or pursuing something, at least investigating the options in foster care. Those are ways you can make a significant difference. There are many organizations in the hallways again this weekend, wonderful organizations that you can talk to, that you can interact with in order to understand how you might connect in a significant way to make a difference, to restore shalom in our community. Remember, these people are going to a lot of work to set up in the hall in order to make it convenient for you. So please take the time to talk to them. Maybe God calls you to be involved in youth ministry or children's ministry and do justice there. There's a lot of need there. I don't know what God might be calling you to. I just know God is calling you to something. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to invite Mike and the team to come back on stage. In just a minute, they're going to sing a song. While they're singing the song, I would invite each of us to prayerfully consider, what is God nudging us toward? What is God calling us to? When you walked in the door, you should have received a piece of fabric and a pen. If you don't have one, raise your hand. One of the ushers will get you one. What we'd like you to do is this. During the song, When the song is over, the band will continue to play. We have plenty of time. You can sit there quietly. But when you have some sense of this is what God's calling me to, we're inviting you to write that on that piece of fabric. You can put one word. You can put a sentence. If you're an overachiever, you can put a paragraph. You can put your name on it. You don't have to. It's really between you and God. You're saying, I think this is what God is calling me to do, to help restore the fabric of shalom. As soon as you have that, then we'd invite you to get up, and you can either come down front, drop it on the stairs. If you just want to drop it in the aisle, that's fine. We'll pick it up. But once you have that and drop it off, then you're free to go. Is that clear? This is our statement of what we're willing to do to restore the fabric of shalom. We'll collect all of these, and by next week, all of them will be stitched into one fabric as our testimony of our commitment to restore the fabric of shalom in Lincoln.